Right. So at first, I'm just going to talk about vectors and some sets of vectors in some n-dimensional complex space. Right. So an f is a function from the set of vectors to 0, 1. And it's a marking function for S. So if for any orthonormal basis in S, it picks out one element. So for all orthonormal bases B in S, the sum of the function values gives you one. Right? It just picks out one element out of it. All right, and S is a Cohen-Specker set if it does not admit such functions. Okay, so originally Cohen-Specker sets were used to prove that there do not exist non-contextual local hidden variable theories. And I guess, hence, the most interesting thing about them is that they do exist. And it follows from Gleason's theorem that was proved, I think, in late 50s. But that was a non-constructive proof. And from his theorem, it follows that Cohen-Specker sets exist in all dimensions higher or equal to 3, but not in dimension 2. And then Cohen and Specker gave an explicit construction with 117 vectors, I think, in 3 dimensions. And then people have sort of been racing with each other to get smaller Cohen-Specker sets, nicer looking, or just on different variations, say state-dependent or independent, and so on. And I've heard that this problem can be sort of addictive. But that's not what I'm going to talk about today. I'm not going to try to reduce any sets to a smaller number or anything like that. So where Cohen-Specker sets have been used, so we already have some history of using these Cohen-Specker sets to construct some non-local tasks. So as an example, maybe the most basic one is this Cohen-Specker game. I don't know where it originally appeared. I've seen like it in early 2000 or late 90s. Basically, this game is you have Alice and Bob who play against a verifier. Alice and Bob are allowed to collaborate but not communicate after receiving inputs. So the verifier gives Alice one of the bases from a Cohen-Specker set, and he gives Bob one of the vectors from the spaces, right? And their task is to assign zeros and ones to the vectors that they have been given. And in order to win, they need to be consistent. So Alice and Bob need to assign the same value, zero or one, to the vectors that they have in common. And moreover, Alice has to obey this marking function requirement, namely, she has to assign exactly one, one. So, quantum players can always succeed using shared entanglement and measurements in these bases, whereas classical players will fail with some non-zero probability. All right, so further, Cohen-Specker sets have been used to characterize certain class of pseudo-telepathy games. So this Cohen-Specker set is an example of PT game. In general, you just have Alice and Bob who play against verifier. And pseudo-telepathy means that quantum players can win with probability 1, whereas classical players win with probability strictly less than 1. And this was done by Renner and Wolf in 2004. So, and in general, all these examples that we are going to see where we apply Cohen-Specker sets are going to be of this type, that quantum players can succeed perfectly, whereas classical players cannot. So sometimes people are interested in non-local games where quantum players can do better, but it doesn't mean they can do perfect. That's not what I'm going to be talking about. I'm only interested in case where quantum players have a perfect strategy. All right, so next, Cohen's Pecker sets have been used for zero-error communication. So they've been used to construct some channels for which quantum players can communicate more messages with zero error than their classical counterparts. And this is from a paper by Cubitt, Leung, Matthews, and Winter in 2010. And lastly, they've been used to characterize graphs for which this parameter called quantum chromatic number is strictly greater than classical chromatic. Sorry, the other way around. The classical chromatic number is strictly greater than the quantum chromatic number. So graph coloring. I'm going to talk more about these last two topics in this talk. Actually, in this talk, we're going to see a full characterization of when you have a separation between quantum and classical chromatic numbers, but it was previously investigated for a special case of when the optimum coloring is achieved with what's called rank one measurements. So this special case was investigated in paper published in 2012 by Simon Severini and Gianni Scarpa. All right, so now let me get to the generalization. All right, sorry, not yet. What I want to do now is define a variant of these Cohen's Pecker sets. And this variant it comes from this paper by Renner and Wolf. And it's called weak Cohen's Pecker sets. So S is a weak Cohen's Pecker set if for any marking function we can find two orthogonal vectors U and V from S, such that function assigns value 1 to both of them. So these weak Cohen's Pecker sets actually capture all the essence of the Cohen's Pecker sets. And when I'm going to do the generalization, I'm actually going to generalize these weak Cohen's Pecker sets. So any KS set is a weak KS set. The reason for that is for a KS set, there is no marking function, right? So any statement about marking functions of Cohen's Pecker sets holds true. For example, this, that for any marking function I can find U, V, blah, blah, right? The other way, the converse does not hold. However, you can always complete a weak Cohen's Pecker set to a Cohen's Pecker set just by adding more vectors. In particular, you need to take any two orthogonal vectors and complete them to a basis, and you're guaranteed to get a Cohen's Pecker set. The reason why I like weak Cohen's Pecker sets better is I think they are kind of more concise sometimes, right, than the regular Cohen's Pecker sets. But they capture all the essence of the Cohen's Pecker sets. Also, all these, whenever you use Cohen's Pecker sets here, you can actually use weak Cohen's Pecker sets. And sometimes, like in Renner and Wolf, they are explicitly used. Okay. All right, so now the generalization. So all we are going to do is, instead of considering vectors, we are just going to consider the cone of positive semi-definite matrices. So now S is going to be a subset. So it's very straightforward. If you wanted to generalize a Cohen's Becker set, this is the way you would do it. So these are just like positive semi-definite n by n matrices. Okay, so now a marking function, in analogy to before, is again a function from set S to 0, 1, such that for any measurement in S, so in other words, for any subset of S that sums up to identity, we have that the function values also sum up to 1. And we are going to call S a projective, so a set of projectors and here I actually mean orthogonal projectors, but I guess if it's a subset of positive semidefinite matrices, it's okay. So a set of projectors S is a projective KS set, again, if for any marking function, F, we can find two orthogonal projectors such that they, okay, yeah, so they are orthogonal and function selects both of them. Okay, so you could go like even one step further, right? And instead of just considering sets of projectors, you can consider sets of positive semidefinite matrices, and it has actually been done. And what's interesting, you get new things. Like you can use these objects in the context where you could not use the regular Cohen's Becker sets. So for example, Cabello has considered sets where you take subsets of positive semidefinite matrices, and in this case, you can prove Cohen's Becker theorem in two dimensions. Recall that like there are no normal Cohen's Becker sets in two dimensions, but you can construct these objects in two dimensions. All right, so how does the picture with all these objects look? So you have Cohen's Becker sets, and then even a bigger class is weak Cohen's Becker sets. And then if you are a little bit sloppy, then you can think of projective KS sets as even a bigger class. So the way we do it, these are vectors, right? Whereas those are matrices. So you just identify the vector with the projector onto it. And now everything makes sense. And then you could draw even a bigger circle under, with the generalized KS sets where you don't restrict to projectors only. All right, so now I'm gonna show you how we can construct objects that exemplify quantum advantage starting from projective KS sets. And I'll start with zero error communication. So like even just to show you how to do it, I have to introduce the framework, like how the zero error communication goes. Okay, so everything is going to happen over a classical channel, right? So we have classical channel N, and there are some inputs to this channel and some outputs of this channel. And Alice wants to communicate to Bob some classical message. using this channel n. And this channel is fully specified by a conditional probability distribution Pyx, which is just the probability to get outcome y upon input x. Okay, so when you want to think about how many messages can Alice and Bob communicate to each other with zero error, it's useful to think about this object called confusability graph of the channel. So the confusability graph so it has vertices corresponding to elements of set X, the input set. And two inputs, X and X prime, are adjacent. So intuitively, if they can be confused by Bob, right? So in other words, more formally, if there exists some Y such that there is a non-zero probability of outputting this y on input both x and x prime. So both of these conditional probabilities are greater than zero. Okay, so let me just give you an example. Let's say our channel gets inputs, just symbols from 0 up to 4, and the same outputs. And it acts as follows. So x gets transformed to x with probability 1/2, and to x plus 1 modulo 5, also with probability 1/2. Right? Then the confusability graph, so it's a graph on the inputs, so symbols from 1 to 4, is just a pentagon. Right? For example, this edge is here because upon both input 0 and 1, I have non-zero probability of outputting 1. Okay, and now what we are interested, so Alice wants to send messages to Bob with zero error, so no confusion can happen. So if Alice chooses to send both 0 and 1, then Bob will always have some chance of being misled, right? Because if Bob sees 1, he doesn't know which was the input. However, if Alice just chooses to send messages 0 and 2, then they're good, right? Because Bob knows, oh, if I see 0 or 1, it must have been message 0. If I see 2 or 3, then it must have been message 2. Sorry, okay. But he's never going to see 4, right? So what you see is that this, I'm going to use a C0 of n to denote the one-shot zero error capacity. Right, so the number of messages that Alice can send to Bob with zero error per one use. So, but this is just equal to the maximum number of vertices that you can pick in this confusability graph, such that no two of them are adjacent, which is in other words called an independence number of the graph. So what's interesting here is that actually it does not matter what our channel is, it only matters what is its confusability graph, right? So that was in the case of classical layers Alice and Bob. But now what we could do, allow entanglement between these them two. They still want to send classical messages, but now they can do quantum measurements on their shared entangled state. But it turns out that even in that case, the one-shot zero error capacity, and now I'm denoting it by star, which means that they have some shared entanglement, only depends on the confusibility graph of this channel. And this was proven in the previously mentioned paper by Cubitt, Leung, Matthews, and Winter. Okay, so because these two quantities only depend on the graphs, we can talk about the one-shot zero error capacity of a graph and the entanglement-assisted counterpart, right? So we will just write C0 star of G and things like that. All right, so what it turns out, and it was also proved in the same paper, that sometimes these two quantities can be different. So there is a quantum advantage for this type of a problem. So C0 of G is sometimes strictly less than C0 star of G. And what I want to show you now is that when you have a projective KS set, you always have this separation going on. So this result is analogous to the one given in this paper, but in this paper they consider weak Cohen's vector set. Okay, so we are going to start with a projective KS set, and we're going to get a separation. So we have these objects. S is projective KS set. And then we list all the measurements in this set S. So S1 up to SK are all measurements in S. So in other words, they are all the subsets that sum to identity. And it's important that we have all of them. And then we're going to construct orthogonality graph. Of S. All right. The vertices are going to be elements in these sets S1 up to SK with repetitions. Okay, so this is multi-set union. So if I have some projector appearing, say, in three of these measurements, I'll have it in this set three times. And edges, so there's an edge PP prime if P is orthogonal to P prime. That's why it's called orthogonality graph. Right, and the statement says that for this graph G, we have a separation. So quantum players can send more messages. Right, I'll give you a brief proof idea. The proof idea carries through straightforwardly from this paper. All right, we want to prove two things. One is that quantum players can send K messages, where K was this number of measurements in S. And the other thing is that classical players cannot. So, but we need to think about some channel, right? Because now we have graph, but we want to think in terms of zero error communication. So I'll send messages to Bob through some channel. And what we can do is we can pick this canonical channel with this confusibility graph. And it works as follows. The inputs come from are the vertices of the graph. And the outputs are edges of the graph. And the probability to get an edge E upon outputting inputting some vertex V is 1/2 if V is an endpoint of E and 0 otherwise. Okay, so now let's think about how this graph looks. So since it's a projective measurement, all the projectors in each measurement are orthogonal, right? So we can think about the graph in terms of the cliques. So each, this SI is going to correspond to some clique. And there are some edges between. So what does Alice do to send some message I? We want to show that she can send K messages. So to send message I, Alice measures the corresponding projective measurement SI and sends through channel the vertex corresponding to her outcome. All right. So now, by the definition of our channel, Bob is going to get an edge that's incident to that vertex. And what he wants to recover is the index of the clique, because that corresponds to the message, right? So there are two possibilities. Either that edge that he got was within some clique, in which case Bob is fine, or it is between. So if it's within the clique, Bob knows which clique it is, so he knows which message. If it's between two of the cliques, what he's going to use is that this is the orthogonality graph, right? So Alice, I didn't say that explicitly, but Alice measures maximally entangled state with this SI, all right? So these two projectors, so what I want to say is that Bob has to distinguish between which of the two orthogonal states he has. So if he has this edge, there's some P and some P prime here, and they are orthogonal. So this is what Alice got. So Bob either gets this P tensor identity psi or the other state, P prime tensor identity. And he just has to distinguish which two orthogonal states he has, and he can do that perfectly. So he can resolve which one of the two cliques it was. All right. So actually, you can also show a weak converse to this theorem. You can show that when you have a separation, then there is an underlying Cohen-Sparker set. But I'm saying it's a weak converse because you can only show it in the case when the separation is achieved with projective measurements on maximally entangled state. And in general, it's not known whether for zero error communication, projective measurements on maximally entangled state are sufficient. All right, so next I'm going to move to the second application of the Cohen-Sparker sets, which is in for graph coloring. Okay, so to start with, just let's consider a graph, all right? And so we want to color it with some C colors. Then a valid coloring, we have a valid coloring if any two adjacent vertices get different colors, right? So say in this case, we color this white, this black, and this checkered, and then this white. So this is a valid coloring. And the chromatic number of the graph is the minimum number of colors. C said that G can be C color. But now we can easily turn this into a game with Alice and Bob and Verifier. And what Alice and Bob are trying to do is to convince Verifier that they can see color some previously agreed graph G. Right, so G C coloring game. So we have Verifier, Alice, and Bob. Alice and Bob are collaborating, but after they receive the inputs, they cannot talk to each other anymore. So Verifier sends two vertices, U and V, to Alice and Bob, and they have to respond, they have to color these two vertices. So they respond some C, color A, and color B. Well, and if they want to win, this needs to look like a valid coloring to the Verifier. So in other words, if CA needs to be equal to CB when they are as the same vertex, and they need to be distinct, the colors need to be distinct when UV is an edge. And when they are not adjacent and distinct, they're Verifier accepts everything. Okay, and we could do sort of the same trick as before. We can now allow entanglement between Alice and Bob. And we could define the corresponding quantity, the quantum chromatic number of the graph G. Okay, maybe before I need to say, so it's easy to convince yourself if a classical player's Alice and Bob can win, if and only if the graph G can actually be C-colored. So this gives a valid coloring, and this forces Alice and Bob to be consistent. So they have to have agreed on some coloring. But now what turns out that quantum Alice and Bob can sometimes convince the Verifier that they have the C-coloring of G, even if G is not C-colorable. And that's what motivates to introduce this quantum chromatic number of G. So it's just the minimum number of colors C such that quantum Alice and Bob can win this game. Now the previous statement that I said that sometimes quantum players can win even though classical ones cannot just means that the quantum chromatic number of G is sometimes strictly less than the regular chromatic number of G. And what we're going to do using these projective chaos sets is characterize all the cases when this happens. But in order to do that, I need to talk a little bit more about how quantum strategies look. Okay, so what can quantum Alice and Bob do? So they get some input. Based on this input, they can decide which measurement to use. And based on the output they got, they can decide which color to assign to this vertex. All right, so without loss of generality, just Alice has some POVMs for each of the vertices or each of her inputs. And the operators in this POVM are labeled by the colors. So if she gets the outcome, she just corresponds the color corresponding to that
outcome. Are you doing again just one shot?
Yeah, so everything
like it's uncatchable at all.
Yeah, we want success probability one. So normally, like, you would be interested, what is the probability distribution with which you are given the inputs? But since we only care about perfect strategies.
Okay, one shot perfect.
Yeah. All right. And so Bob also needs his strategy. So he has some POVMs. FV. And again, indexed by the colors. And they have some state that they are measuring. Right. All right, so these three objects specify a quantum strategy. All right, and then we are going to call a strategy quantum C coloring of G if, using this strategy, Alice and Bob can convince verifier with probability one that they have this C coloring of G, even though maybe they don't, as we know. All right, so quantum C coloring is a strategy. So classical coloring is an assignment of colors to the vertices of the graph, but quantum C coloring is the strategy. So there is a nice fact proven about these strategies. That says if you have some quantum C coloring, actually you can choose it to be of a specific form. And this was proven by Cameron, Newman, Montanaro, Severini, and Winter in 2006. So it says that if the quantum chromatic number of G is less or equal to C, in other words, there is a quantum C coloring, there is this strategy for C coloring G, then there exists a quantum C coloring of G in normal form. And by normal form, I mean that these two things are satisfied. The first one says that these POVMs are actually projective measurements. Moreover, Alice's projectors are just complex conjugates of the corresponding Bob's projectors. And this state psi can be taken to be maximally entangled. All right. So now, with the help of this theorem, saying that we can always choose our strategy to be nice, we can characterize all the graphs with the separation. So if G is a graph, and we are gonna let C be its quantum chromatic number. So then we have that chi Q of G is strictly less than chi of G, if and only if for all quantum C colorings the set formed by throwing together all of the Alice's projectors. So we take union over all the vertices and all the colors. Is a projective Cohen-Specker set. All right. Well, basically, this tells you that there is a separation only in the cases where you have some Cohen-Specker set lying behind. Now, I wanted to use the two theorems to get from a separation between the chromatic numbers, I wanted to get a separation between the channel capacities. Unfortunately, I erased the theorem that I wanted to use, but I'll remind you. So this corollary is basically going to say that projective chaos sets allow us, starting from a separation between these chromatic numbers, obtain a separation between the zero error one-shot capacities. So if we have some graph G, for which we have this separation between chromatic numbers, so chi q of G is strictly less than chi of G, then the entanglement-assisted one-shot zero-error capacity of graph G prime is strictly greater than its classical counterpart. And this G prime is the orthogonality graph of a projective chaos set that we have as Alice's strategy to achieve this chi q of g, like we saw in the previous theorem. So these PV alphas just come from some quantum C coloring of this graph G, where C is exactly the quantum chromatic number of G. Just to remind you, so that in the orthogonality graph here, we had to take if there were some projectors appearing several times in several measurements, you had to repeat sort of those vertices. All right. What you could say, though, that maybe sometimes you know that there's a separation between the chromatic numbers, but you don't know an explicit strategy, so you might wonder, how do you get this G prime? What we can actually show is that for the graph G prime, you can take this explicit graph, which is just Cartesian product of G with the complete graph on C vertices. This is not necessarily the orthogonality graph G prime, but both of these graphs would give you a separation between one-shot capacities. All right, thank you for your attention.